Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. Take your phone calls if you have questions about the Bible, about the Christian faith, about things you may disagree with the host about. Feel free to give me a call. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. I just want to say that once a month there's a Zoom meeting open to anybody where I do a Q&A. It's actually hosted by a church in Portland, Oregon, or at least in Oregon. I think it's in Portland. And I just come to my computer and do it once a month, and that's coming up tomorrow night. And you're welcome to join us if you're interested in knowing how to log on to that. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. And go to the tab that says announcements. Go on down to tomorrow night's date, which is, of course, May 5th. And you'll find the login information if you'd like to join us there. All right, we're going to go to the phones now and talk to, Brian from Leander, Texas is our first caller. Brian, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Brother Steve. Grace and peace to you and your family.
Thank you.
My question is for out of 1 Corinthians chapter 14. I'll read it real quick. It says, the women are to keep silent in churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but are subject to subject themselves, just as the law also says, and that's out of the NASB. My question is, where is that found in the law? In my reference Bible, it just goes to 1 Timothy chapter 2:11. Of course, that's not the law. So, what do you believe Paul is referring to there? Thank you. I'll take the question off the air, sir.
Okay, Brian. Thank you very much for your call. Yeah, this is 1 Corinthians 14, and he says that let your women keep silent. This is verse 34. Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak. They are to be submissive, as the law also says. Now, the law would be the Torah, or sometimes Paul refers to the entire Old Testament as the law, but most often it's going to be the first five books of the Old Testament called the Torah. That's the law. And he says the law says what he's saying. Now, what is he saying? He's saying the women should keep silent in the church, but he's also saying they should be submissive. I believe it's the latter line that he's saying the law would say. He says they should be silent in the Corinthian church because they ought to be submissive, such as the law says. Now, the submission of women to their husbands is something that the law says in Genesis. Genesis chapter 3 says that the woman's husband would rule over her. And so that would be probably what Paul has in mind. In Deuteronomy, there's some other things about, you know, men having charge over their wife and children's matters. For example, if a wife or a child makes an oath to do something, let's say to give away some of the family property or something like that, and the husband has not heard about it, as soon as he hears about it, he can cancel their oath. But if he does hear about it and waits a day or so and doesn't cancel it, then they're bound to keep it. So, again, it looks like the husband has the veto power. To veto commitments that other family members have made. Well, this is no doubt because the husband, you know, is giving direction to the family. He's the one who earns what's being brought into the family. And he, you know, if somebody's making decisions to impact the family's finances negatively, he has the right to say, no, that's not the, you know, I brought in these finances and therefore I'm going to have the last say about what happens to them. Now, in general, we see in the Bible, not only in the Bible, but throughout history through most societies, that the husband was the head of the home, and that most societies were, for the most part, led by men. There have been women in politics and women in spiritual leadership throughout history in different religions, including Israel's religion. There were prophetesses, just like there were prophets. There was Miriam, who led the women of Israel. She was the sister of Moses. So that women might be in leadership in some capacity, especially over other women, was never controversial. That they would take charge over the men would be controversial, definitely, in most societies. And until our very modern society, for women to be in charge over men now is not controversial in our modern age among secular people. But throughout most of history, men were recognized as the leaders. And that was written into the law of Moses. So when Paul says they should be submissive, I believe he's, and he says that's what, as the law says, I think he's saying that he's not making this up. This came from way back there. And when he does in 2 Timothy, or 1 Timothy chapter 2, talk about women not being the leaders or the teachers of the church, he says because the man was made first and the woman was made second. And basically he's saying, you know, God made man to be the leader and woman to be the helper. Now, in saying that, we find that in Genesis. So that's also in the law. So Paul resorts to the law, especially the creation stories and the fall, when he's talking about the basis for male and female behaviors in the church and in the family. Now, the church is simply regarded to be a family. Now, a woman doesn't have to be silent in all respects in the church, although he says, let them be silent here. He's talking about in the context of them causing a disturbance. He also, in the same chapter, says that if one wants to, in verse 28, says, if there is no interpreter, then the one who wants to speak in tongues should keep silent in the church and let him speak to himself and to God. Now, keep silent would mean, of course, with reference to speaking in tongues. The person doesn't have to be in all respects silent in the church, but if they want to speak in tongues and there's no interpreter, let that person keep silence, again, in that particular activity. Now, what activity were women being told to be silent about? Well, again, this has a lot to do with the surrounding material. The church in Corinth was very disruptive by people who didn't behave in an orderly manner. Paul's last sentence in this chapter is, let all things be done decently and in order. And there were, apparently in the church of Corinth, women who were being disruptive. The fact that Paul says, if they want to know anything, let them ask their husband at home, means, well, at least most interpreters mean that they were asking questions during the church, that they were perhaps interrupting the speaker, or maybe even just talking out loud to their husbands, asking, hey, what's that guy mean when he says that? And there were some women who simply were not being considerate of the order and so forth of the church and the sanctity of the situation. So Paul's telling them to be quiet, just stop doing that. Now, when you tell someone to be quiet or silent, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can never speak in any situation. But they were behaving in a, as he put it, a shameful way. And so he was telling them that they should be silent in that activity. Now, elsewhere in the same book, in 1 Corinthians 11, he has said that women can pray and prophesy under certain circumstances in the church. So we know that Paul is not opposed to women praying or prophesying in the church. Therefore, he's not suggesting absolute silence of women must prevail in the churches. But in the particular case of this church, there was apparently disruption from women asking questions in the middle of the meeting, apparently loud enough or in a way that was disrupting things. And Paul says, tell your women to stop doing that. Tell them to be silent. And don't ask those questions. You know, ask their husbands at home. So I don't think he's putting some kind of a rule on all churches that women cannot speak in the church. But I think he's saying in this particular church, there's a great deal of disruption from too many people speaking in tongues all at the same time without interpretation, apparently from women asking questions during the service, from who knows what else. We know that at communion, they had a disruptive meal where some people were taking too much food and not leaving enough for others. This was a pretty immature group. And Paul had to really rein in on them on a number of points that he might not have given the same instructions to a church that was behaving itself already and was not, you know, causing a chaos. So the instructions that Paul gives to the Corinthians, we sometimes have to ask, are these like are these instructions he would give to every church of all times? Or are these instructions that are suited to the particular problems that they were creating? And he is writing a letter to stop, to address those problems. I think in this particular case, that's probably what he's doing. And I think the evidence within it is sufficient to justify that opinion. All right, let's talk to Tom from Tacoma, Washington. Tom, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about Peter and John. And as we know that John's family apparently was acquainted with the high priest, and he was able to take Peter into the courtyard of the high priest, and John himself went on in the house, we assume. And also John was present at the crucifixion without calling much attention to himself. Jesus, talked with him from the cross and told him to take care of his mother. My question comes in John 22, verse 20. And I've listened to your verse by verse on this, but one phrase in it wasn't addressed. When Peter was talking to Jesus, he turns to John, and then he asks Jesus, says, "Who betrayed you?" As if he didn't know. And I just wondered if Peter, at 40 days after the resurrection, did not know Judas was the one that betrayed him, or whether he was a little bit suspicious of John, since he apparently was acquainted with the high priest's family and stuff. Any comments on that?
Yes, I do. I think you're misunderstanding how John is phrasing this sentence in John 22:20. It says,
okay.
Then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following. Now John adds, this was the disciple who had leaned on Jesus' breast at the Last Supper and said, "Lord, who is the one who has betrayed you?" Now he's saying, this is the same disciple that I mentioned to you about a couple chapters ago at the Last Supper, when Jesus said, "Someone's going to betray me." Peter said to John, "Ask him who it is." And John asked him and said, "Lord, who is it that betrays you?" Now, that's perhaps the last thing. Well, that's the identifier that John is using to tell us which person he's talking about here. So if you look at, let's just say, after the word following, if you put in parentheses the words, "who had leaned on his breast at supper and said, 'Lord, who is it who betrays you?'" close parentheses, you would say that whole section is clarifying who this beloved disciple is that John has just mentioned in his narrative. Peter saw that beloved disciple following. Now, in case the reader doesn't know who that is, that's the same disciple that was at the Last Supper and asked Jesus that question. So that's just a parenthetical clarification in that the rest of that verse. So if you just take the parentheses out, which is how you can read a sentence, it says, then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following. Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "But Lord, what about this man?" So that whole other section at the end of verse 20 is a parenthesis from the author telling the reader who this beloved disciple was.
Okay, that clears that up. I had thought that he was asking Jesus who was the one that betrayed him. So that answers that question.
Yeah,
thank you very, very much.
Yeah, that's written in a confusing way. I appreciate you asking. God bless you. Okay, let's see. We're going to look now at, we're going to talk now to Dominique from Millbury, Massachusetts. Dominique, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'd like to get your opinion on when they talk about biblical masculinity. Like I was listening to a couple pastors and on YouTube, and they were talking about I don't want to I hate to name the names, but like Hillsong and Bethel Music, and I kind of felt that way when I started listening to Christian music too. They were like love songs to Jesus, and I kind of always felt a little bit uncomfortable with some of those songs, because it's almost like they're kind of feminine songs, and they were talking about that masculinity needs to get back into the church.
So the pastors were discussing those kinds of songs and saying those are an evidence of a loss of biblical masculinity. Is that what these pastors were saying?
That, and were just saying how Hillsong and Bethel, and I don't want to, like...
Okay, I get you. I was just trying to clarify your question. I think I understand it now. Well, first of all, yeah, a lot of modern songs do sound a little bit like romantic songs.
Yes, that's what I was trying to say.
Right,
I'm sorry.
Right, they sound like the singer is singing a romantic song to Jesus, as if our love for Jesus is of a romantic sort. And if they justified this, they would say, "Well, we're the bride of Christ, and He's the groom." Well, the church as a whole is the bride of Christ. But the church as a whole is likened to a man in the Bible. There's many metaphors for the church. And the bride of Christ is not there to define the sexuality of the church, but rather a kind of relationship that a bride and groom have other than romantic. I mean, certainly a romantic relationship is part of that. But more the idea of the wife having him as her head and protector and provider. Not the idea that she's got a crush on him. Now, I find that many times female Christians have less problem than male Christians do in singing what sound like romantic songs addressed to Jesus. And for obvious reasons. Jesus is a hero. Jesus is the greatest. And, women quite naturally can feel romantic feelings for great heroic men. And so, I mean, for a woman to feel kind of romantically toward Jesus, that's not what they're supposed to feel necessarily. But I'm not saying it's evil. I'm not saying it's, it's not sexual or anything like that. So it's not, it's just that women respond in love to a man in many cases differently than a man responds in love to a fellow man. And so it should be that a male Christian should have no trouble singing about his love for Christ. Remember, Jesus asked Peter 3 times, "Do you love me more than these?" And Peter said, "Yeah, I love you." And he said, "Well, feed my sheep." But he was not asking, "Do you feel romantically toward me?" Of course. And so, I mean, a man, if he sings a song that's written as if it's a romantic song of love to Jesus, is obviously going to make a man feel awkward. And I don't think songs should be written that sound, or should be sung in church, that sound like it's a romantic love for Christ. Our love for Christ is more like the love a servant has for his master. If his master saved his life and has shown great generosity to him, his loyalty to his master and his devotion to his master and his gratitude to his master would be more the expressions of the love, not so much a romantic feeling. So I do think that many modern Christian songs, it's not just Hillsong and Bethel and those guys, although they may be guilty of this too, but for a long time, at least since the 80s, I would say, I've noticed that a number of worship songs toward Jesus sound like love songs such as secular love songs, romantic songs. And I don't feel like that's the norm. I don't think that should be the way it is. I don't have any problem singing about my love for Christ, but my love for Christ has no romance in it at all. It's not a romantic love. There's lots of different kinds of love. And so I think if a church does feature worship songs that sound like, love songs, worship songs, I should say romantic love songs to Jesus, that's going to alienate men. That's going to alienate men. And I don't think it's the right way to worship. I don't think it's correct. So I don't know these preachers that you mentioned, but I would have some of the same objection. I can understand how women might. Pat Boone's daughter, Debbie Boone, had a hit song back in the 70s, "You Light Up My Life," which made it, it was a pop 40 hit. And it sounded like a love song to a guy. But she was a Christian, and she, in her own heart, was singing it to the Lord, I think she said. Well, a woman might sing to the Lord like that, and it might seem natural to her. But for a man to sing to Christ as a woman would sing to a man would, I think, would be more awkward for most men. And I don't think they should be subjected to that, church. I think we should sing hymns that are substantial, not merely emotional. See, what makes a song romantic is it's an emotional song. Well, fine, let us have our emotions toward God, but let's have appropriate emotions. And when we sing songs, let's sing songs that are not merely emotional, but are true, and that affirm our truth and our faith and our resolve and so forth. Not that just talk about how we get butterflies when we think of Jesus, you know.
Yes.
So I guess I would share that criticism.
Yeah. And my next question, just last one quick, is, like, and I think I've always misunderstood, you know, when Jesus says, turn the other cheek, and, you know, like, we're supposed to let ourselves be bullied, and we're supposed to let ourselves be, picked on. But then I heard a pastor say, no, that's not the case. Like, Jesus got angry. Like, Jesus wasn't a nice guy. Like, you know, they say, like, there's a difference between a nice guy where, you know, he lets anything go and he's just a nice guy. But Jesus got angry and he stood firm on what he believed. And they were saying how that sometimes gets in the way, people thinking, like, you know, like Christians are meek because we're supposed to be. But in actuality, there's a strong sense of masculinity in a Christian man.
Well, hopefully. I mean, there are men, Christian and otherwise, who have more of the traits naturally that we associate with masculinity. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure how to enumerate those traits. But and there are men who naturally seem a little more soft and, you know, maybe even a little more effeminate. Now, I don't think men should be effeminate. But there are times when some men just, you know, the way their behaviors or their temperament is or their personality is might seem more effeminate. But certainly a man is called upon to be courageous and to have backbone and to stand for what he believes. And not to be a pushover at all, but on issues where it's appropriate for him to absorb insults and not to respond, that is a manly thing to do, too. Jesus did that when they spat on him, when they beat him, and he didn't open his mouth. To my mind, that's a very masculine response on his part. I mean, if we think I'm asking, I would say, hey, you do that again, I'm gonna, you know, deck you. Well, that's one kind of response that men, some kinds of men would give. But I think men have to be courageous. Jesus was certainly courageous. He went toward the most, you know, horrific death willingly, knowing it was the right thing to do. But on the other hand, being courageous doesn't mean that we don't absorb insults and injuries and so forth out of love for our enemies, too. I mean, I don't think there's just one response that we can attach to every situation. I think that we have to just apply the spirit of Christ, the spirit of the love of God we have toward people, even our enemies, in the situation. Sometimes turning the other cheek is the kindest thing to do. But if it is, it's also going to take a lot of manhood. It's going to take a lot of courage. If you say, okay, I could maybe beat this guy up, or at least give a good, effort at it. Or if that's not going to please God, I can also absorb another strike, you know, on my other cheek. If that will show that I'm not a violent person, that I've got self-control. Self-control is a hugely manly, I think, trait for men or women. Frankly, I mean, it's a strength. It's a show of strength when you control yourself and you don't let your emotions, you know, just drive you to do something that, you know, any fool could do. In fact, almost it would take more than a fool to refrain from doing. So, yeah, some people might want to make Jesus out to be some kind of a tough guy. I don't think Jesus was a tough guy, but I think he was an uncompromisingly strong man. And so I think that's what I think Christian masculinity should be that way.
Cool. Thank you very much.
All right. I appreciate your call. Thank you for joining us. All right. Well, we've got more calls. We've got another half hour coming up. In just a moment, I'm going to hear music that tells me I have to take a break at this point. But again, don't go away. We have another half hour. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and we have a lot of things besides the radio show going on. For one thing, we have an app. We have our website. And at both the app and the website, there are hundreds and hundreds of resources. And so you can use those. And they are free. There's nothing for sale at The Narrow Path. We don't sell anything on the air, and we don't sell anything on the website. And it would be impossible to get me to sell you something. But I'll be glad to give you something. And everything at the website is free. Now, of course, my books are there, but they're not offered there. They are simply, if you go to the website, you'll see what my books are. I don't sell them. You can't buy them from the website. You can buy them elsewhere, though. We just let you know about my books there at the website. And you'll have to go somewhere else to buy them. Because, again, we're not a selling organization. It's just not what we do. So we do depend, therefore, on listeners to pay the radio bills. And if you would like to help us do that, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Of course, you can do that from our website, too, which is thenarrowpath.com. Now, I'll be gone for 30 seconds, but I'll be right back, so don't go away.
Tell your family, tell your friends, tell everyone you know about the Bible radio show that has nothing to sell you but everything to give you. And that's The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. When today's radio show is over, go to your social media and send a link to thenarrowpath.com where everyone can find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And tell them to listen live right here on the radio. Thank you for sharing listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are going to be going to the phone lines again. We take your phone calls throughout this hour, or this is another half hour. We've got a half hour behind us. And if you'd like to join us, we have lines that may open up during the half hour. Right now, the lines are full. You may want to have this number handy. The number is 844-484-5737. I got an interesting email this morning. I won't give the person's name. It's a woman. And she says, I woke up and the Lord said, follow the narrow path. I looked up the narrow path and found you. I shall be interested to listen to your teachings. So when she woke up this morning, the Lord spoke to her and said, follow the narrow path. Now that could have more than one possible meaning, but at least she looked us up, and I don't know, maybe she's listening right now. We appreciate her writing about that. Let's talk to Scott from Phoenix, Arizona next. Scott, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. Have you ever heard of a man named Roy Masters?
Mm-hmm. Sure have.
You got any commentary on that?
I've never listened to him. He's been on the radio for decades. As I understand it from what I've picked up over the years, and I am no expert on this man. I don't know his teaching specifically, but I believe he's a New Age kind of a guy. He does talk about Jesus a lot, and he comes off a little bit like a Christian, but I believe that his ideas are actually New Age ideas, like so many others. But I don't follow him, so I can't really parse his theology for you.
Yeah, I heard him on the radio 15 years ago or so, and I started listening because I was very immature, and anytime I heard somebody talking about Jesus, I just thought that they were, you know, a faithful Christ follower or something, but I've come to find out that isn't always so now, I think.
Right.
But he was a former hypnotist. He just died a few weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't know.
And yeah, he was a former hypnotist, and I think you're right about he was New Agey, but he always kind of talked about how women were kind of, I guess you'd say, evil and trying to curse their children and their husbands and stuff like that.
Well, I've never heard that. Never heard that from him or really anyone else. But, yeah, that's, I had not also heard that he had died. But, yeah, just for anyone who's wondering about Roy Masters, his, I don't know if his show will continue in recorded shows after he's gone, but, yeah, he does talk about Jesus, but he's not really preaching a biblical, gospel. All right, let's talk to Wes from Omaha, Nebraska. Wes, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thanks for having me. My question is, I have a cousin that was a Christian for 17 years, but now he says that he's not a Christian. He doesn't believe in Jesus anymore. Not that he doesn't believe in Jesus. He believed that Jesus was a man, but he believed that he was actually a fraud, and he was not the Messiah. The Messiah did not come. His basis for this, he says, is the Bible itself says, well, the Bible itself showed him and others that Jesus was not the Messiah. It sounds to me like first century Jews. But one example or one thing he mentioned is that if God hated human sacrifice so much in the Old Testament, why did he sacrifice his son? It seemed like that's pretty backwards. And I thought my cousin was a Hebrew Israelite, but the Israelites, they believe Jesus is the Christ. He doesn't. So I don't know what sect he's part of, and I don't know really how to talk to him about this.
It's a shame there are so many ways to go wrong. I mean, because it's not that hard to go right. All someone has to do is use common sense and apply it to the reading of the Bible, and you won't go very far wrong. It's when you start getting into these strange conclusions. I mean, for example, all the information we have about Jesus that would give us insight as to whether he's the Messiah or not comes from the Bible itself. And the Bible, the New Testament, was written by people who believed Jesus was the Messiah. So nothing they reported about him would, in their minds, give any evidence that he wasn't the Messiah. So, I mean, a person could say he wasn't the Messiah if they reject the New Testament. But the New Testament writers would certainly not provide and do not provide anything that would suggest he's not the Messiah. So I don't know where else he's getting information. Now, I have no idea what group he's in or anything like that. But as I say, there's a thousand ways to go wrong, just like in any, you know, on any subject. If you're asking questions about history or about mathematics or about, you know, scientific things, there's a right answer. And there's an infinite number of wrong answers people could give. You know, 2 + 2 equals what? Well, there's one answer that's right, and there's an infinite number of wrong answers. Everything that isn't 4, and there are many other numbers besides 4 that could be given, is a wrong answer. So, I mean, people should be more interested in looking at evidence, taking a logical, common sense approach to the sources. For example, the sources of the life of Christ we have are from his friends, people who walked with him, people who died for him, for the most part. And, you know, taking the material they've given and seeing what it points to. Now, I don't know what he means when he says Jesus didn't do what the Messiah should do.
He said that Jesus didn't fulfill the Masonic, prophecies, and that Messiah is still to come.
Well, the Jews who rejected Christ, of course, thought he had not fulfilled the Messianic prophecies, but their understanding of those prophecies was different than Jesus's. Jesus did fulfill the Messianic prophecies from the way he understood them, and the apostles understood them, and you know, a Christian would say the way God understood them, you know. What he didn't do that the Jews wished he would have done was, you know, deliver Israel from the bondage to the Roman authority and gather all the diaspora of Israel from the four quarters of the world back into Israel. That's what the Jews believed the Messiah would do. He didn't do that. But he made no apologies. He knew that's what they thought the Messiah should do, but he made no apologies for it. He followed a mission that we now see in retrospect did fulfill the prophecies, but not in the way the Jews thought. It's interesting that Jesus never publicly declared himself to be the Messiah. He did tell some people he was the Messiah. He privately told the woman at the well that he was the Messiah. He told his disciples privately, rather late, actually, in his ministry at Caesarea Philippi. He affirmed that he was the Messiah. And then when he was before Caiaphas and he was asked about it, he affirmed he was the Messiah. So there's no question that Jesus saw himself as the Messiah. What's interesting is that in 3.5 years of public preaching, there's no reference to him ever saying, I am the Messiah. In fact, he was so reticent about saying it publicly that the Jews came to him in John, I think it's chapter 8, I'm not sure, it might be 7, and they said, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you're the Messiah, tell us, you know. And he even didn't answer them directly then. So we know that Jesus being the Messiah was something he knew, and he shared it with intimate friends, but he never really declared it publicly, which means, of course, he was not like other people who were false messiahs, who were trying to convince the Jews that they were the Messiah, but they really weren't. Jesus didn't try to convince anyone that he was the Messiah. He didn't even declare himself publicly to be the Messiah. But Christians, but he knew he was. He spoke to people privately about it. And Christians who know him know he was, because we see that he did fulfill the prophecies, but not in the way the Jews hoped. And therefore, there's going to be a difference of opinion about that. Of course, the Muslims have a different view of Jesus, too. And, every religion is. Hinduism's got a different view of Jesus. Buddhism does. But what makes us Christians is that we have the same view Jesus did about it. And we follow his claims that he made, and we see the prophecies that he fulfilled, and we find them persuasive. All right, let's talk to Bob from Texas. Bob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment and then get your reaction to it, see if I'm thinking okay.
Okay.
I'm thinking about killing myself in a couple years, and let me tell you why. I am the caretaker for my wife, who has dementia and is progressively getting worse, and I see a time where I will not be able to take care of her. And I do not have the means to put her somewhere to be taken care of, except that I do have a life insurance policy that would supply those means, but it will run out in a couple of years. And so I'm thinking of sacrificing myself to be able to take care of her in such a manner that I feel like would be acceptable. And I don't really see it much different than throwing myself on a grenade to save, my fellow soldiers or anything like that. I find it in line with, laying down my life for the person that I love. And other than defrauding the insurance company, do you find any error in my thinking?
Well, I do. But defrauding the insurance company would certainly be one of them, because you don't want the last thing you do on the face of the earth before you meet God to be, robbing an insurance company by claiming something that they would not cover normally. I mean, I assume you're talking about killing yourself in a way that looks like an accident so that I'm sure your insurance company does not cover suicide. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, so if you make a false claim on because of fraud, that's robbing. That's committing an act of robbery, and you wouldn't want the last thing you did to be both an act of murder and an act of robbery, because you're going to stand before God. I always thought it was strange when people thought Jesus was going to come on a certain date, because they followed some crazy teacher who gave them a date for the second coming, and so they run their credit cards up because they don't expect to ever pay them back. So you want the last thing you do before you stand before God to be robbing, people, taking, borrowing money that you don't intend to pay back so that they're left holding it back. I mean, I don't understand that. Now, I do understand and sympathize with your concern, and that you compared it with falling on a grenade. I understand that. If something you did would save her life, and you knew it would in the moment, and you sacrificed your life for her, I would not see that as the same thing as suicide. But this is premeditated, and it's for a situation that its outcome is not known. You don't know but that she herself might die around that time or before. I mean, we all could die any time, or that you might die naturally. But I guess you're saying if you don't die naturally, if she doesn't die and she's still around, that you'd want to do that to provide for her. I would say that would not be, in my opinion, an honest way to do it. When a man really sacrifices a life for someone, he hopefully does that without making victims of other innocent people. And to defraud others would be not an act of true spiritual self-sacrifice. It's man's reasoning that you're doing, and you're not taking God into account. I'm sure you think you're doing something that would be very Christ-like to lay down your life for her. And we should be prepared to lay down our lives for our wives. That's exactly what Paul said. Paul said, husbands, love your wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. But again, giving yourself for somebody else's life would only apply to certain very unusual situations. Like if somebody's torturing you and planning to kill you unless you reveal the whereabouts of your wife so they can kill her. And you say, no, go ahead and kill me. I mean, that's laying down your life. I think that you need to take God into account, because God has made promises to take care of those who are his. And so when you come to the end of that insurance policy, if you can't renew it or whatever, you just have to trust God, either to provide for you in a way that you can take care of her, or to provide for her once you're gone. And God is faithful. And yet we never have to commit a sin in order to do the right thing. To do the right thing, if we have power to take care, you have power apparently right now to take care of your wife. If that power ends, then you fall completely on God to do that. And I will say this as somebody who's lived 50 years just depending on God to take care of my family with no visible means of support. God is faithful. God is faithful to do that. And that is something he may want you to learn. If you kill yourself, so your wife can have the insurance benefits, you may be missing out on one of the most important lessons God wants you to learn before you go. And that is how he provides and how he can be trusted. I mean, this decision you're making is well-intentioned and comes from, you know, your own commitment and love to your wife, but it is not an act of faith. And whatever is not of faith is sin, the Bible says. So I would say one thing you really need to learn, hopefully before you die, is how much God can be trusted. And, he will not put you in a situation where he is unwilling to take care of you in it if you're trusting him. If you come 2 years from now, your insurance policy runs out, there's no obvious way how you'll be provided for and your wife will be provided for, that's when you'll find out. If God puts you in that position, he will never put you in a position that he won't provide for you in. And there may be something totally, there will be something totally unexpected, unforeseeable at this moment that God will do to take care of the situation, assuming he wants you and your wife to survive beyond that point. We don't know if any of us will be alive 2 years from now, so, I mean, it's kind of presumptuous. But we should know that whatever happens, God is faithful. Now, do you have children?
Yes, I have a daughter, but I did not want to burden her with the...
Right. We don't want to burden our children, but God might want them to bear that burden. Again, that might be part of their growth, to say, listen, my mom, you know, she took care of me when I was helpless. Now my mom's helpless. I should take care of her. It might be the most virtuous thing your daughter will ever do, and it might be the thing that God wants for her to do. And, of course, we don't want to lay burdens on people, but you're not doing it. I mean, if the only way you can avoid laying that burden on your daughter is kill yourself, and that's not an option, then, I mean, it may be that your daughter will be the one that will step up. And whether you like to put the burden on her or not, she might not be unwilling to do it. And even if she doesn't want to do it, it may be what she's required to do. And you have to realize that you committing suicide will be a burden on your daughter, too. I don't know that she would appreciate. I don't know your daughter, and different children have different attitudes. But good children, generally speaking, would rather their father not commit suicide, so that the child, can help step up to help with the burden the father was bearing before and can't anymore. So, I mean, you're not seeing the full range of options here. And there's more. Because if you should die, or if you should simply be incapable of supporting your wife and you both will be in a position that the Bible says the church community should support. If you're in a church community, you are, I guess I didn't ask this, I was assuming, you are a Christian, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
And you are in a, are you in a church community?
Yes, a very strong one.
Okay, well, realize that if you and your wife are, let's say, disabled and unable to support yourselves, the church really should step up. Your daughter, the Bible says your daughter should step up first, but if she doesn't, then the church should step up. And so you do have possible support networks that you're not taking into consideration. I think you need to, and I don't think that suicide should even be regarded as an option. It looks like something that would work out for your wife, but I think she'd be better off having you than having your money. And you know, since you have an adult daughter, that certainly is a function. And you've got a strong church. Boy, you've got much more of a support network than many people have. So don't do sinful things in order to remedy a problem that there are righteous remedies available for. All right, Bob?
Thank you, Steve. It was good to get your perspective.
All right, Bob. God bless you. Thanks for calling. Charles from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Hi, Charles.
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
Good. Thanks.
Hang on a second. I got to get through an intersection without getting arrested here. Okay. so you gave me some homework to figure out how to solve the youth of road dilemma, I believe.
How to solve the what?
I'm sorry. You may, on Friday, we talked briefly. Let me put you on speakerphone here real quick. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm not. You're kind of distorted. Your voice is kind of distorted. Hard for me to understand.
Is that better?
Could be. Go ahead. Start again.
Okay. On Friday, we talked. I'm an atheist who's a big fan of your program, and we were talking about grounding morality and
murder being
wrong and how. And you asked me to call back with an answer to that, and I don't remember now exactly your specifics, but did you say without appeal to Judeo-Christian ethics or without
appeal to God? Without appeal to God, I'd like to hear how you ground any ethical system, any absolute ethical system.
Then I'm not sure one can. But I'm not sure that appealing to God actually does it. I would have to, quote, prove my grounding for murder is wrong. If you say God says it's wrong and I ask you, okay, I will accept that, but show to me there's God, it simply pushes the issue back one. I think we each have to stand.
Well, it does, but the thing is, there are many evidences for God. You don't have to accept them. But if you reject them, then you have to find something else, to ground your rules of life in. You're gonna have to live by certain rules, certain standards that you adopt. So you have to know what to ground them in. Go ahead.
That is true, but that doesn't mean that the ethics that I would then appeal to are groundless, just because they're not grounded in God.
Well, if you don't know what they're grounded in, they might be groundless. Yeah.
I would point to murder being wrong as something that predates any Judeo-Christian value because it predates both Jews and Christians.
True. That is so true.
It seems like that is a common human value.
Well, wait. Let me just say this. Murder as a crime or a sin does predate Judaism and Christianity, but it doesn't predate God. God is the one who is being violated when we destroy one who is made in his image. Now, the question is, let's say there's no God. There's two possibilities. One, there's a God. One, there's not. If there isn't a God, then evolution has created us. Evolution certainly doesn't condemn murder. Animals kill those of their own species all the time.
No, evolution isn't a philosophy that could condemn murder.
Exactly.
Evolution is simply a scientific observation.
Right.
It's not a philosophy. Humanism could condemn it. And here's how humanism would ground it.
Go ahead.
because rather than tell me what can't be done, let me tell you how it is done.
Okay.
Humanism would take the value of human life as not the only good and not the fundamental, as a fundamental unprovable assumption. If I have to argue with you about why human life has value, we're probably not going to argue very far. It's a fascinating philosophical discussion, but I have to build a society with people around me, and I feel most comfortable with those who think that murder is wrong. That's only a starting point. Whatever motivates me to decide murder is wrong is then extensible to other things. You have fascinating conversations this hour with a whole bunch of people on a whole bunch of issues that are before the law that we all have to live with, whether or not we believe in God. For yeah. some of them, you presented non-God-based arguments. For others, God-based arguments.
Okay.
It seems to me that if you have to appeal to God, that that's a difficult sell, because is it the Hindu God, the Muslim God? God can't be a reason for a policy in a secular society, in one that includes us all.
Well, not in a secular life. But let me just say, Charles, there are there are false gods. There are false religions. I mean, you know, Zeus was a false god, and Neptune was a false god, and Poseidon's a false god, and so forth. We believe there are false gods. But that doesn't mean there's not a real god. And if there is a real god, then he is the creator of us. And as the creator, he created us to function in a certain way, just like if I invent a vehicle of a certain kind that's a novel, one that no one has made before, I would design it to work on in a certain way. And if people use it the wrong way, it's going to destroy the vehicle, and it's just going to be the wrong way to do it. And so if God made us to be a certain way and told us what way he's made us to be, then doing it a different way is, first of all, wrong, because he has the right to tell us what to do, but because he has the patent on the product, but also it's going to be damaging to us. So, I mean, we can't really say for sure why, you know, sex outside of marriage is always going to be a bad thing. But God says, no, that's got consequences that you can't even fathom. Not just, let's say maybe you get a venereal disease or get pregnant, but there may be spiritual consequences that he knows that we don't. The thing is, he's the one who told us how to function. And
sure.
So,
okay,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but I don't want to
get
too far off of it, because that all may be true.
Go ahead. We only have a few minutes.
Yeah. Moment. Oh, I'm sorry. For the moment, because as an atheist, I wanted to correct you, or a small thing, which in casual conversation, atheist simply means not convinced of God. Case hadn't been made. That's all that means. There's no
that's
other
the new definition.
Things to come.
That's the new definition.
That's what it means.
Let me correct you. A chair doesn't believe in God, but it's not an atheist. Atheism
right,
is a position.
Is a thinking being.
Atheism is a position. Okay.
No,
a position has to take some stand on something.
One question.
Okay.
Please, Steve. Let me. It seems to me that you're assuming a bunch of philosophies that I would say are more rightly and accurately characterized as humanism. However, for our conversation, I would say, okay, yes, I understand what you mean by atheist values, non-God values.
Charles, listen, I want you to call back. Could you call back early tomorrow?
I have a job, and I have to kind of squeeze it in. Sorry.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry, because I would like to talk to you for a half hour, but I'm out of time. I don't even have half a minute left. So if you would call back sometime when you get a break, I'd love to talk to you more, but this is just frustrating. I have to quit.
Good luck to you, Steve. Peace.
Thanks.
To you.
Thank you, Charles. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. We have an app by that name, too, and you can hear this program and all the resources from our website there if you'd like, thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.